Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Update on Early-Stage Breast Cancer. This is such an important program to offer during Breast Cancer Awareness Month, during this month of October, and this is a program that is supported by not only Cancer Care, but about 40 other cancer-related organizations. Many of them are actually breast cancer organizations as well. And because of that collaboration, we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today, both because of your interest and the collaboration. We have over 1,139 participants on the call today, so this is a large call, and you come from all over the United States. You come from different areas of this country, different regions. And we also have international participants from Canada, Egypt, Italy, Kenya, Malaysia, Tunisia, the United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you can see that this is, you're from all over the world. It's a bit of a global call. Now, today's activity was made possible by Genomic Health, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of the program. I also, before we begin, just want to remind all of you that we very much appreciate your completing the evaluation forms that you received from Cancer Care in your materials. We very much depend upon your feedback in planning future programs, and we are approaching 2015 and planning many programs for next year, and your comments to us could not be more timely. And also, all of you have a very good handle on what would be helpful to you, what would be most helpful to you in the programs that we develop for you. So please take a moment and tell us what you want, and we'll try very hard to implement it. We take your recommendations very seriously. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Catherine Ruddy. And Dr. Ruddy is Director, Cancer Survivorship, Department of Oncology, Mayo Clinic. Dr. Ruddy has extensive expertise in breast cancer, and she's going to address overview of early-stage breast cancer, diagnostic testing, treatment options for early-stage breast cancer, including clinical trials. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Ruddy.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. It's really a pleasure to be invited to speak today on this very important topic. I'll start by just introducing the concept of early-stage breast cancer. This is really breast cancer that has not spread outside the breast and the underarm area, which we call the axilla. And we usually treat this very aggressively with breast and underarm surgery, often accompanied later by radiation, anti-estrogen pills, and chemotherapy in many cases, to reduce the chance that this will ever come back both in the same place and also, most importantly, elsewhere in the body. Patients with early-stage breast cancer often have the option of either removing part of the affected breast, which is a surgical procedure called a lumpectomy, or the whole breast, which is called mastectomy. Radiation is almost always needed to reduce the risk that the cancer will come back in that remaining breast tissue if someone has a lumpectomy, while many patients who have mastectomy do not need radiation afterwards. Patients also have choices about systemic therapy. And systemic therapy refers to treatments that go throughout the whole body. They're usually administered intravenously or by pill. And the goal of these is to kill off cancer cells and reduce the chance that the cancer will come back elsewhere in the future. So how do we decide what treatments a given person needs? Stage is a big part of this, and stage refers to really how large the tumor is and how many lymph nodes it has spread to, usually under the arm. We also pay attention to the grade of the tumor, and the grade refers to how fast the tumor looks like it's growing when it is investigated under the microscope. And breast cancer grades range from a grade 1 tumor, which looks like it's very slow growing, to a grade 3 tumor that looks like it's faster growing, and in the middle is the grade 2 moderately rapidly growing tumors. All breast cancers are also tested for estrogen receptor and progesterone receptor, and these determine whether anti-estrogen treatments, which are treatments that either block the estrogen receptor or reduce estrogen levels in the body, will be effective therapies. All tumors are also tested for HER2-new, which is a protein that is overexpressed on about 20% of all breast cancers. And that protein impacts the type of chemotherapy that we would recommend. Most of our chemotherapy courses for early stage breast cancer take between 12 and 18 weeks, and generally we're giving patients at least two drugs on those same days. And typical side effects from these chemotherapies can usually include hair loss, often fatigue, and also some other side effects. We know that the efficacy of these treatments is greatest in patients who have estrogen-insensitive cancers, so estrogen receptor-negative cancers, and also in patients who have HER2-positive cancers. In 1997, a new treatment against HER2-positive breast cancer revolutionized our therapy of these cancers, and that drug is called trastuzumab, or Herceptin. It's a monoclonal antibody that allows us to selectively target these HER2-positive breast cancers and really effectively kills these off. And for that reason, we recommend chemotherapy for almost all HER2-positive breast cancers because our treatments are just so effective. It's also important to know about the anti-estrogen treatments that we often recommend for breast cancer. And these treatments are usually given in pill form, and patients are asked to take them daily for between 5 and 10 years in most cases. For premenopausal women, the usual anti-estrogen treatment that we recommend is called tamoxifen, and that can be given, again, between 5 and 10 years. For postmenopausal women, tamoxifen also works, but there's another class of drugs that's also a possibility, which is the aromatase inhibitor class of drugs. And the aromatase inhibitors actually reduce the amount of estrogen in a postmenopausal woman's body compared to the tamoxifen, which blocks the estrogen receptor. And these are both very effective treatments against estrogen receptor-positive breast cancer. I want to talk a little bit about two tools that we sometimes use to make treatment decisions for patients with early-stage breast cancer. And one of these is called Adjuvant Online. This is a web tool in which we clinicians can enter information about a patient's age, other health problems, the estrogen receptor status of the tumor, the grade of the tumor, and the tumor size and lymph nodes involved, and can get an estimate of what the benefits will be for a given patient of giving anti-estrogen treatments and chemotherapies. And that can be very helpful. It does not fully give us everything we need in terms of understanding the biology of some of these cancers. And so there's an additional test called Oncotype DX that we sometimes recommend for patients where we're having trouble really understanding whether a patient will benefit from chemotherapy or not. And with this Oncotype DX test, this is a test that's actually sent on the tumor specimen itself, and 21 genes are assessed that give us an idea of whether the cancer will be very well treated with anti-estrogen treatment alone, meaning that chemotherapy is not necessary, or whether adding chemotherapy to anti-estrogen treatment, in fact, giving the chemotherapy before the anti-estrogen treatment, will significantly reduce a person's risk of the cancer coming back in the future. And I want to note that clinical trials are really a very important piece here. Clinical trials are ongoing to develop better ways to assure that we understand who will benefit most from which of these treatments, and research is really key to our efforts to understand how to precisely select therapies based on tumor biology and risk of toxicity. And with that, I'll stop.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Dr. Reddy. Very informative and very helpful in setting the stage in terms of the treatment of early stage breast cancer. And our next speaker is Dr. Sylvia Frumenti. Dr. Frumenti is the Sondra and Edward H. Mayer Professor of Radiation Oncology, Chairman of the Department of Radiation Oncology, Professor of Medicine, Associate Director, NYU Cancer Institute. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Frumenti.
I am a radiation oncologist, and I'm going to talk for a few minutes about what is the role of radiation therapy in the management of early breast cancer. And indeed, the radiation therapy plays a big role in the journey of a breast cancer patient. And what we are doing today is really the result of a lot of effort over the past 20, 30 years in trying to create the evidence that is, in fact, inform the protocols of management of breast cancer today. And several large trials with a lot of women who volunteer to participate in these trials have created the evidence that enable women to now keep their breast instead of undergoing a mastectomy, particularly in early breast cancer. But have shown, also shown that, you know, in order to maintain the integrity of your body and not give up the breast, you need to receive another component of treatment, and that comes from ionizing radiation from radiotherapy. And, you know, in one hand is really great news because, of course, the integrity of the body is very, very important and has a big impact on quality of life. On the other hand, it's created an extra step for each of the patients and an extra set of information and understanding in this complicated journey that is the process of taking care of an early breast cancer. So what does radiation do? Well, radiation is something added to a segmental mastectomy or lumpectomy, which is a type of surgery that removes the original tumor after an initial biopsy is usually done to document that it, in fact, is a malignancy. And radiation usually targets the entire breast tissue. In early breast cancer, most of the time, radiation just irradiates the breast. In some cases, there is indication to also irradiate the armpit, the axilla, where draining nodes exist. But in general, you know, the target is the breast tissue. And the idea is that radiation eliminates residual microscopic deposit of possible tumor cells or activated cells that may promote recurrence in the breast if the breast, in fact, is maintained if it's in the absence of a mastectomy. So one interesting concept is that while surgery is important, an important component of the management of early breast cancer, the process of surgery induces some kind of inflammation and a wound that requires repair. That same repair that enables healing of the wound sometimes may encourage residual cells to grow. And it is exactly on that specific step, on the specific set of signals, the radiation can intervene and interrupt them and, in fact, work so well with breast preservation, assuring that women who undergo segmental mastectomy or lumpectomy can enjoy the same outcome they used to enjoy or they enjoy today if they choose so when they have a mastectomy. So mastectomy is really equal to radiation and lumpectomy in terms of both local control and survival. Most women prefer to keep their breasts, so most women undergo lumpectomy or segmental mastectomy followed by radiation. And over the past 20 years, we have refined how to best do radiation. First of all, the original radiation was, you know, it required a lot of visits to a radiation department. It is done with a machine that delivers a specific dose around the shape and the size of the breast, very individualized. And it requires used to require 5 to 6 weeks of daily visit Monday through Friday, so approximately 25 or 30 visits to a radiation department. A lot of research has shown that many women could not have this kind of access for distance, other reasons, you know, the difficulties of keeping their jobs with a lot of absences and so on. So there was a lot of stimulus in trying to reduce the number of these visits. Our group very much participated in this effort, and, you know, together with many other centers in the United States, and particularly in Canada, we were able to show that, in fact, 3 weeks is as good as 5 weeks, and most probably as good as the 6 weeks that we use to prescribe to our patients. So the very first success through a series of clinical trials that have demonstrated equivalence is that, you know, is really reducing the number of fractions. Another success has been in identifying some patients, usually elderly, a little older women, postmenopausal women, that have very small breast cancers and, you know, somehow with better characteristics, meaning hormonally sensitive small tumors, that could be susceptible with less than the entire breast irradiated, meaning the radiation is focused only, is directed only to the cavity where the tumor used to be and some margins around the cavity. That approach is called partial breast radiation, and that enables even a shorter course of radiation, down to 1 week. And of course, these women are particularly happy because their visits are limited to five to a department of radiation oncology. So one good thing about radiation, whether it is for five fractions or for 25 or 30 fractions, is that it doesn't hurt. Usually it's very well tolerated. Patients are not radioactive after they are never radioactive, as a matter of fact. And, you know, the radiation is on only when the patient is in the radiation room and doesn't present any exposure to any family member, is not a risk for anybody. But radiation is an issue of a lot of precision and a lot of technical proficiency in designing fields to target correctly the breast, ideally while sparing at best the normal tissue. And in the chest, the normal tissue close to the breast is the chest wall and the lung, and particularly for patients who carry breast cancers in the left breast, the heart. So our group has spent a lot of time designing trials that will optimally spare the heart and lung from the effect of radiation. And we have figured out that, in fact, by putting the patient in a prone position, so lying on her stomach instead of lying on her back, we could best avoid the heart and the lung. And we're very much indebted to the patients who have enabled us to study them in a trial we conducted that we published in a journal called the Journal of American Medical Association, JAMA. We showed in a large cohort of patients that 200 had right breast cancer, 200 had left breast cancer, who generously accepted to undergo imaging both lying on their back and on their stomach, that when they lie on their stomach, we could best spare the heart and lung, meaning once we were targeting the breast and trying to treat the breast for each patient, we could compare plans of treatment, both lying on our back, supine, and lying on their stomach, the same patient, prone, and consistently lying on their stomach was superior than lying on their back in avoiding the heart and lung. Since then, many centers are offering the possibility of treating patients lying on their stomach, and most women derive benefit from that position in terms of avoiding their heart and the lung. So this journey in figuring out how to best avoid normal tissue when you target the tissue of the breast is an example of how clinical trials can make a difference. And if I can make a recommendation to the listeners, is to always consider, doesn't mean everybody has to get into a clinical trial, but always inquire about clinical trials, because clinical trials are definitely our way to make progress as scientists and as clinicians, but also offer an opportunity to look into the future. And generally, certainly in breast cancer, there are no placebo trials that are going to be offered in radiation, so everybody's going to get radiation. Is just most often they compare one type of radiation to another, and a lot of safety measures are built in, so the risk is very, very limited. And definitely, it doesn't matter you're going to participate into a clinical trial, but it's really important to learn and be informed about the clinical trial, because it will give you a kind of an insight about your condition and the areas where there is less evidence. Most of the trials are really built to try to create more evidence and understand better how to take care of a disease. So it's very informative to inquire about trials. So I think I will stop here for the time being, and I want to thank Dr. Messner for inviting me. Thank you again.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Frumenti. That was so informative, and also you're highlighting the importance of clinical trials as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Aditya Bardia, and Dr. Bardia is attending physician, Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Bardia is going to address tailoring the treatment to your particular breast cancer, practical tips to manage treatment side effects, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Bardia.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's my pleasure to participate in this important activity. Welcome, everyone. Increasingly, it is being recognized that breast cancer is not one cancer. It is a conglomeration of multiple cancers. Currently, breast cancer is divided into three major subtypes based on the receptors that are present on the surface of the cancer cell. Receptors are like gates which allow entry of substances inside the cell. Based on standard pathology, breast cancer is currently divided into three major subtypes: hormone receptor positive breast cancer, which means that either the estrogen or the progesterone receptor or both are positive on the cancer cells; HER2 positive breast cancer, that implies that the HER2 receptor is positive based on standard criteria; and triple negative breast cancer, when the three receptors, the estrogen, progesterone, or HER2 receptors, are all negative. Breast cancer is also divided based on the stage, which looks at the size of the tumor, the involvement of lymph nodes, and spread of lymph nodes outside of the breast, as well as the grade, which refers to the degree of differentiation of the tumor. That is how close the cancer represents and resembles the original morphology of the breast. The treatment of breast cancer, including localized breast cancer, is based on the subtype of the breast cancer. If the breast cancer is hormone receptor positive, usually the mainstay of treatment is endocrine therapy. Currently, aromatase inhibitors are considered the first line for endocrine therapy for postmenopausal breast cancer. There are three FDA-approved aromatase inhibitors, exemestane, letrozole, and anastrozole, and studies have shown that they all have equivalent efficacy and similar toxicity profile. The common side effects include hot flushes, musculoskeletal symptoms, and decreased bone density. Tamoxifen is another endocrine therapy that could be considered, particularly for premenopausal breast cancer. The common side effects of tamoxifen include blood clots, hot flashes, and small but known risk of increased uterine cancer. For HER2-positive breast cancer, the mainstay of treatment is monoclonal antibody called Herceptin or trastuzumab that binds to the HER2 receptor cell and prevents its signaling. The mainstay of treatment for HER2-positive breast cancer involves the use of this antibody along with chemotherapy agent. Last year, FDA also approved another monoclonal antibody called pertuzumab for the management of HER2-positive breast cancer. Pertuzumab is very similar to Herceptin or trastuzumab in that it blocks the HER2-positive cell but does it in a slightly different mechanism, and both of these drugs work together and are used for localized breast cancer. I would point out that the use of pertuzumab currently is limited in what is called the neoadjuvant setting, which means it should be used before surgery. That is how it was approved by the FDA. The third type of breast cancer is the triple negative breast cancer, and the mainstay of triple negative breast cancer is chemotherapy. There are various chemotherapy regimens that one can use, and it's best to discuss with your primary oncologist as to what would be the best regimen for a particular breast cancer. In general, that decision is based on the stage of the tumor as well as the goals of treatment. In terms of common side effects, the common side effects of chemotherapy per se include nausea, vomiting, fatigue, and decreased blood cells. Nausea and vomiting can be a particularly distressing adverse effect. It is important to consider the unique side effects that come with the medications that are used for controlling nausea and vomiting. The common medications include Compazine, Ondansetron, or Zofran. Zofran in particular can cause constipation and headache, so should be used accordingly. Fatigue is another common adverse effect of chemotherapy. And one thing that I would like to highlight is that besides considering common medications, it's important to consider complementary therapies as well for fatigue. Recent studies have shown that regular exercise can reduce fatigue. Studies have shown that yoga can also reduce fatigue. So there are other strategies that one could consider when combating fatigue that can occur with chemotherapy and sometimes with radiation therapy as well. Often during chemotherapy, a medication called Neulasta is used. That medication is used to increase the white blood cells, which can get reduced with the use of chemotherapy. A common side effect of Neulasta is pain and musculoskeletal discomfort. A recent clinical trial suggested that the use of anti-inflammatory agent, over-the-counter NSAIDs, can reduce the pain that comes with Neulasta, and that is something that can be considered. General infection precautions should obviously be considered when using chemotherapy, as it can affect the immunity and decrease the white blood cells. There is also a subtype of breast cancer called stage 0 or DCIS, which is ductal carcinoma in situ. That is not invasive carcinoma per se, and the management of DCIS includes surgery along with consideration of tamoxifen for chemo prevention. Overall, I would like to emphasize that it is very important to discuss the management of your cancer, not only with your medical oncologist, but also surgeon and radiation oncologist. The management of breast cancer requires a multidisciplinary approach, which involves the surgeon, radiation oncologist, and medical oncologist. This is particularly important when chemotherapy is being considered. For example, if chemotherapy is being considered before surgery, what is called neoadjuvant chemotherapy, then it is very important to discuss this with the surgeon so the plan can be made as to how to evaluate the lymph nodes, how to monitor the breast cancer during chemotherapy, as well as the investigations needed before surgery is conducted. So this can be planned appropriately and there is no delay in treatment. It's also important to involve the radiation oncologist so a plan for radiation can be made even before chemotherapy is started. Finally, I would like to emphasize and agree with what was said earlier in terms of importance of clinical trials. The standard we have right now is based on clinical trials that were conducted in the past, and it is very important that patients consider participation in clinical trials so further progress can be made.
I'd like to thank you very much, Dr. Bardia, for your excellent presentation, and very informative as well, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Allison Nielsen. And Ms. Nielsen is an oncology social worker and our Women's Cancers Program Coordinator at Cancer Care. Ms. Nielsen is going to address the free psychosocial support services offered by Cancer Care and the role of support groups. Ms. Nielsen?
Thank you, Dr. Messner. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you today and speak with you on this program. As an oncology social worker, I work with many women coping with breast cancer as well as their loved ones. And I'd like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how cancer care can be a part of that network. There are many ways in which we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer care programs include individual counseling, available face-to-face in the New York area and over the telephone nationally, support groups available face-to-face in New York City and over the telephone or online nationwide, education about resources and navigating the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance. All of our services are provided by licensed master's-level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer impacts a person and his or her family and friends. They are experienced in helping cancer patients and their loved ones tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as the financial demands, physical changes, social adjustment, and psychological impact. Adjusting to and coping with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. As you probably know, breast cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. It can often be confusing and overwhelming. The good news is that you do not have to walk this path alone. When you ask for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling, that's a sign of strength. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others in a similar situation where you can share thoughts, feelings, information, and ideas about cancer. And individual counseling provides a space that is just yours to voice any concerns and process your emotions. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Feeling well emotionally can help you deal better with the diagnosis and treatment. At this time, Cancer Care offers a support group over the telephone for women with cancer. There is also an online support group available for women specifically with early-stage breast cancer of any subtype. And women with breast cancer in the New York tri-state area can attend our face-to-face in-person support groups. We offer specialized face-to-face groups for young adults with cancer ages 18 through 40 and women who speak Spanish. We also offer support groups for caregivers or family members who have a loved one with cancer. If you're interested in any of Cancer Care services, please call our HOPE line at 1-800-813-HOPE to speak with one of our oncology social workers. You may also wish to visit us online at www.cancercare.org. Our comprehensive website is a place to find a lot of additional information on your cancer diagnosis and the treatment you need to receive. As we've learned a lot today from this early stage breast cancer program, you might need some guidance in digesting it all. Our social workers can help you understand what it means for you and your family. Cancer Care Services are here to help you. Know that you are not alone. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Nielsen. That was excellent, and excellent review of Cancer Care Services and the role of support groups. Now, we do have time for questions. I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board and to actually explain to the audience how to queue up for questions. And we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Now, if we do not get to your question in this time that we have, please know that you can call Cancer Care at the number Allison had given you, 1-800-813-HOPE. And I'll repeat that question again toward the end of the call because our staff are here to help you with any questions or concerns, not only that come up for you today, but may come up for you over the next weeks or months ahead. So, Stephanie, could you explain to everybody how to queue up for questions? And we'll try to take as many as possible. And please bring all of our speakers on board so that we can all be here to answer their questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Gina J. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering if there have been any studies done on cumulative toxicity with the 10 years of tamoxifen versus the 5. I've completed the 5, and I'm kind of vacillating as to, it's recommended that I do 10 by my team, but I'm just wondering if there have been studies done on cumulative toxicity of tamoxifen.
That's an excellent question, Jen. Thank you very much for asking it. I'm going to ask Dr. Ruddy to address it in a general way, and then, of course, we do also encourage you to take what you learned today and bring it back, of course, to your team and ask them that same question as well. But Dr. Ruddy?
Yes, so a very important question. The study that did show us that 10 years of tamoxifen was slightly better than 5 years in terms of reducing risk of recurrence did look at toxicity, so it did investigate rates of our most serious toxicities, the uterine cancer and blood clots, and did find some small increases in those with the longer therapy. Now, we don't have data 50 years down the line. We have 10 and 15-year data looking at the longer course of tamoxifen. The decision about whether it is worth the additional small toxicity for a given person from doing the additional years of tamoxifen really comes down to, at least the way that I counsel my patients, comes down to what was the risk from the original cancer. So how much risk are you at that the cancer will come back, and is it worth taking that what appears to be pretty small additional risk of toxicity? And also, how are you feeling on the tamoxifen? So obviously, the toxicities of tamoxifen are not just what's your risk of blood clot and uterine cancer, but is the tamoxifen making you miserable from the hot flashes?
Excellent. Thank you so much. And our next question, Stephanie?
Our next question comes from Catherine Kay. Your line is open.
That was the question I wanted to ask.
Oh, okay. That's an important question. Thank you. And our next question from one of our online participants is actually, is there better care today for lymphedema prevention and aftercare? Should one avoid needles in the arm where the lymph nodes were taken? That's an excellent question. It's a question that many people wonder about. Dr. Bardia, could you address that question, please?
Absolutely. Lymphedema is an increasing problem that occurs among breast cancer survivors. Fortunately, there are various strategies that one can employ to reduce the risk of lymphedema, especially with the Z11 study, which showed that you can avoid axillary dissection among certain group of patients who have positive lymph nodes, and also with improvement in techniques with radiation oncology, as well as a better recognition that lymphedema is indeed a problem among breast cancer survivors. So with all of these interventions, lymphedema is much better managed now. Now, as far as whether needles or blood pressure cuffs should be avoided, if there is a possibility that the other arm could be used, then definitely the other arm can be used for looking at the blood pressure or for blood draws. But in terms of actual evidence that frequency of blood draws or blood pressure cuffs cause increased lymphedema, the evidence is very limited.
Excellent. Thank you. And our next question from one of our online participants actually has to do with what can I do to protect myself from the flu during cancer treatments, during cancer treatments? So Dr. Ruddy, could you address that question?
Sure. Well, I think there are two ways to protect against the flu. One very important way is the flu vaccine, and the other way is to try to do good hand washing and try not to have too much exposure to people who are obviously ill. And I think both of those are very important.
Thank you. And is there any particular advice around the type of flu vaccine one should get in terms of
I don't have, Dr. Body, do you have any comments on that? I don't have any specific recommendations about any specific type of flu vaccine.
I would agree with you. What the vaccine that is used in the hospital or in the clinic, that would be the one that I would recommend. Every year, based on the specific strain, they anticipate the vaccine that would work best, and that is the vaccine that I would recommend. So whatever your primary care physician or the oncologist has in their clinic would be acceptable.
Excellent. Thank you. And then we have another question from our online participants regarding what is the most effective way to increase your white blood cell count during cancer treatments. Dr. Bardia, could you address that?
Yes, decrease in white blood cell is a common complication of chemotherapy. The medication that can reduce the risk of the white blood cells going down is the medication called Neulasta or pegfilgrastim. It is a medication that is given 24 to 48 hours after chemotherapy. It is given as a subcutaneous shot and essentially gives a boost to the bone marrow to increase white blood cells. In terms of other interventions, there are no interventions based on clinical trials besides the use of the growth factor support that can increase white blood cells. We would, in general, recommend avoiding contact with patients who are sick and following general infection precautions.
And we have another question for you, Dr. Bardia. I have stage 1 triple-negative breast cancer without node involvement. I had 6 rounds of chemotherapy. My question is on pain management. I had chronic pain and inflammation before my diagnosis. During chemo and now 4 months post-chemo, everything is intensified. What kind of natural ways can I deal with this? And I just want to say to everyone that we do have a program tomorrow totally covering triple-negative breast cancer. That'll be the focus, but nevertheless, the question is today, and so Dr. Bardia, could you address this, please?
Absolutely. I think it is important to understand the etiology of the pain. Is the pain coming because of a side effect of chemotherapy in terms of neuropathy? Is the pain coming because of some procedure that was done related to surgery, be it the biopsy or lumpectomy or mastectomy, and it is a pain secondary to the surgical procedure, or whether the pain is coming because of lymphedema? I think understanding the etiology would be the first step in addressing the pain. If the pain is coming because of a side effect of chemotherapy, such as neuropathy, then it needs to be managed with appropriate medications that that deal with neuropathic pain. And there have been a couple of trials which have looked at different medications that can specifically address neuropathy-associated pain.
Well, thank you so much. And the next question for Dr. Ruddy, how effective is the letrozole for IDC and side effect? Dr. Ruddy?
Letrozole is a very effective medication for invasive breast cancer. So this is one of the aromatase inhibitor drugs. There are actually three drugs in that class. One is letrozole, one is anastrozole, and one is exemestane. And all three drugs reduce the risk of a breast cancer coming back in the future by almost 50% if that breast cancer is estrogen receptor positive. Now, the downside of these medications is the side effect profile, and for many women this can be difficult. We know these medications cause significant hot flashes in most women. Also, about a third of women have pretty significant joint and muscle pain from these, and vaginal dryness is the other issue that many of my patients find quite problematic with these medications. One additional side effect to mention that isn't necessarily something that patients notice but can occur is bone thinning, because with the reduced estrogen levels, the bones do thin over time with these medications.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And so we recommend that you would please discuss this again with your treating healthcare team to review all the options available to you. Thank you. And we have one of our questions from another one of our questions, so Stephanie, from someone on the telephone. Yes.
Our next question comes from Don S. Your line is open.
Hi. I actually have a couple of questions. I was wondering on one of the options that I've been provided is a nipple areola sparing mastectomy, and I was just wondering how common you've seen those procedures kind of recently. I know they weren't real common in the past, but based on what it's my understanding, it's been more common kind of recently. And then also was wondering if it's okay to be around young children. I have a six-year-old when you're going through radiation.
Thank you. Those are excellent questions, Don. And Dr. Ruddy, if you could address those two questions. Thank you.
Sure, I can attempt to address those questions. I'm not a surgeon or a radiation oncologist. With that caveat, in our institution, we have seen an increase in the use of nipple-sparing mastectomies. The rationale for that is that it is more cosmetically acceptable. There are certain criteria that need to be met in order for a patient to be eligible for nipple-sparing mastectomy, and that relates to the size of the tumor, the location of the tumor, and proximity to the nipple. I would suggest discussing this with your surgeon and seeing whether you would be a good candidate for nipple-sparing mastectomy. In terms of long-term data, at this time we don't have long-term data comparing nipple-sparing mastectomy to full mastectomy, but it is something that is increasingly being used at our institution and other institutions. In terms of being near children during radiation, in general, the common side effects of radiation is fatigue, and it, in general, does not affect the white blood cell count that much, which causes a risk of infection. So in general, that would be okay, but I'm not a radiation oncologist, and it would be good to discuss this with a radiation oncologist as well.
Thank you. Dr. Brody, do you want to add anything to the issue of the young children?
Yeah, I guess I would just like to say that I certainly care for many young women who have young children when they're undergoing even quite immune toxic chemotherapy, and I also have patients who are nursery school teachers, so even if they don't have kids at home, they're coming in contact with a lot of young children. And my personal experience is that these women do very well, and I think that it is unrealistic to expect that you're not going to be hugging your children during any of our treatments. And I think the best that we all can do is kind of protect ourselves with hand washing. But I want to reassure you that I think the risks from coming in contact with children are really not as substantial as you might worry that they are.
And Ms. Dilson, do you want to comment on just the fact around children and their moms and just those relationships, how critically important they are during treatment and just how you're in support groups?
Yes, absolutely. Well, as Dr. Reddy mentioned, I think this is an issue that comes up frequently with younger women who have children as they're going through treatment. Also, certainly if women are grandmothers or otherwise have younger children in the family. In my experience, it's important to talk with children about the cancer diagnosis itself in developmentally appropriate ways, to use the word cancer where appropriate, to talk to children about the diagnosis and educate them about how the treatments will change their routines, if at all. You know, even saying things like, you know, mommy might be tired from these treatments, so she might not always be able to play with you as she used to. But that reassuring children that they're still loved, they're still supportive, perhaps other relatives will be taking different roles, but to really have an open discussion with children and help them process their concerns and ask any questions, because sometimes the explanations that children make up about cancer in their heads might be worse than the reality. So we find that it's helpful to have an open discussion with kids about the diagnosis, and there is a lot more information about speaking to children on our website, which is cancercare.org.
Well, thank you. And our next question, Stephanie?
Our next question comes from Joyce R. Your line is open.
Thank you so much. I actually have two questions. Can someone please explain the difference between Prosigna assay PAM50 testing and Oncotype testing? Does the Oncotype testing have a greater predictive value of chemotherapy? And my second question is, some comment, please, on being in the ambivalent position of intermediate risk category from a PAM50 test.
Okay. Excellent questions, Joyce. Thank you. Dr. Ruddy, would you please address these questions?
Yeah, the Prosigna test that you are referring to is another way to look at biology of cancer and chemosensitivity, and I think both it and the Oncotype DX are very similar in terms of the information that they give you. And in both cases, unfortunately, many patients do end up getting a result that is in the intermediate category, where we're still left with uncertainty about the utility of chemotherapy. And then the decision-making really comes down to the physician and the patient sort of looking at the risks and benefits and making the best decision possible. But I sympathize with you. It's not, when we send off these tests, we are hoping for a clear answer, and we don't always get one.
Excellent point. And Ms. Nilsson, do you want to comment just on the discussions and support groups about these issues and some of the challenges they present?
Well, Joyce, you're certainly not alone in terms of grappling with uncertainty and a lack of a clear right or wrong answer when it comes to some of these tests and cancer in general. Counseling can be a very helpful option in terms of communicating some of those needs and concerns, and also support groups can be a wonderful way to get some guidance and understanding from women who have been there. So perhaps hearing other people's stories could be a way to manage some of this, in addition to speaking with your medical team.
Thank you. Thank you very much. These are wonderful questions. This is an amazing group today, I must say. This is an incredible group of both speakers and participants. And our next question, please, Stephanie.
Our next question comes from Charlotte B. Your line is open.
Hi. Thank you all for providing this presentation. It's very, very informative. My question concerns radiation therapy. I'm currently going through chemotherapy, and in a couple of months I'll have the radiation therapy. But I wanted to ask Dr. Fementi regarding the 3 weeks versus 6 weeks, and then she mentioned something about postmenopausal women who are older and just having partial breast radiation. And I was wondering how often is it being used in terms of 3 weeks versus 6 weeks, and how old are these women that she references that are only getting partial breast radiation?
Well, thank you. Those are excellent questions. And we will want you to discuss this with your own radiation team because that they know you the best. But I'm going to ask Dr. Ruddy if she could just address this in a general way so it could give you some helpful guidelines on this. Dr. Ruddy?
Yeah, I am not a radiation oncologist, but my experience with patients being treated with radiation, with partial breast radiation, is that radiation oncologists are trying to hone in on what the best population is to offer the partial breast radiation. There's still some uncertainty about exactly how broadly this can be disseminated and who will have the best outcomes with the different types of radiation. The radiation oncologists are working to develop shorter courses of radiation so that women don't have to be coming, not all patients necessarily need to have 6 or 7 weeks of radiation the way we were doing several years ago. And the same is true with the partial breast. There are some women probably who can be very well treated with radiating only part of the breast rather than the whole breast. Age, as you say, does play into this. We know that older women tend to have cancers that are less aggressive, and there seem to be some older women who may even not need radiation at all after a lumpectomy because their cancers are so indolent, so low in terms of likelihood of coming back. And this is all sort of the research is ongoing, and we really do need more research to try to hone in on exactly what the right population is for these different types of radiation. But I would encourage you to talk with your radiation oncologist about what the data is for women who are like you.
Thank you. Excellent. And with a question about from one of our online participants, my family has a history of breast cancer, and I was just diagnosed. Should I have my children tested for BRCA 1 and 2? Dr. Ruddy, could you address that?
So the decision about who should be tested for BRCA, and this is BRCA 1 and BRCA 2 are both genes in which we know that mutations can be associated with an increased risk of breast cancer, and these can run in families. So when there is a family where we have seen a lot of breast cancer or a lot of ovarian cancer, which is another cancer associated with these genes, we do recommend BRCA testing. We also recommend BRCA testing for various other reasons, including men with breast cancer. We recommend have BRCA testing because we know that male breast cancer is associated particularly with the BRCA2 gene mutation. Also, women who are diagnosed with breast cancer at a young age. So what I would encourage you to do is to speak with your clinician about your particular family history and risk factors and decide whether the BRCA testing is right for you.
Thank you. And I have another question. What have studies shown regarding young versus older women undergoing chemotherapy for early stage breast cancer? Dr. Bardia, could you address this question?
Absolutely. There has been a lot of research looking at the tolerability of chemotherapy among women who are elderly, particularly greater than the age of 65, and whether abbreviated forms of chemotherapy can be used. Consistently, studies have shown that the best chemotherapy regimen should be used when considering chemotherapy for early breast cancer, but this should be carefully weighed against the side effects and potential toxicity profile. It should also be weighed against the other comorbid conditions as well as medication that a patient is on. So as long as the risk-benefit ratio is favorable, chemotherapy can be considered. The monitoring of patients who are elderly on chemotherapy needs to be a bit more frequent as compared to someone who is young. And also the potential for drug-drug interaction needs to be carefully considered.
Thank you. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers today. You've been an amazing team, I must say, and I want to thank all of our participants on the call who've asked really such really informative questions. And we know that you may have many other questions, and this is, of course, in planning a one-hour program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So I do want to remind all of you that you have access to Cancer Care Services after the call ends. We are soon to end the call, and that goes on endlessly for you. And you can call us at 1-800-813-HOPE or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. And we are here to provide a host of services. Ms. Nielsen reviewed many of those services, but just to recap, we offer practical and financial assistance, counseling, all these things are free, online and telephone support groups, workshops like this. We also have many publications and a very active website with lots of information. Perhaps most importantly, we do not want anyone to leave this call today feeling that you're alone. We want you to know that you're part of a community of support and we're here to help you. I also wanted to mention again that tomorrow we are offering a program on triple-negative breast cancer in African-American women, and it's actually going to be tomorrow on Friday from 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. Eastern time, and we welcome those who might be interested to listen to that program if you haven't already registered for that. Again, as we conclude today, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone. You are part of our community of support, and we're to help you. Thank you all, and have a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect, and everyone, have a wonderful day.